Hello and welcome to a new English edition of my podcast Helium Talk, das Kunstgespräch. My name is Jörg Heikos and my guest today is Ken Harmon Hashimoto. Well, not only has it been a while since my last podcast, but this one has also been a while in the making. I wanted to speak with Ken already in April, but we only recently managed to get together online. You can guess that it has been and still is a busy time for people running any kind of art business these days, and Ken not only runs three gallery spaces, Spoke Art in New York and San Francisco and Hashimoto Contemporary, also in San Francisco, but The People's Print Shop and Paragon Books. So I hope you enjoy my chat with Ken, which is, by the way, number 80 of the Helium Talk. Well, not counting a few excursions that have no number and some of the TV shows that didn't make it to the world of podcasts yet. But before we get into this number 80, though, there are a few things I'd like to say. There are several reasons for the lack of regularity of my podcast these days. It is actually pretty simple. Reason number one, I do not have enough time to do all the things I'm doing. You all know I have a good career as an artist for almost 30 years, and that is the main thing I need to focus on. Also, there's still the autobiographical book my publisher is waiting for me to drop into his lap and that I haven't had time to continue writing since March. Then, of course, we have the Helium Cowboy Gallery, where we just opened a very strong show with intense abstract work by Morten Andersen from Denmark, Paul Schrader from Hamburg, and my new side project Flaum van Cruisen. While my oldest son Melvin is taking over more and more of the gallery work, it is still a lot more than a full-time job for both of us. That'll change too, and there will be some big news regarding Helium Cowboy soon, but you gotta wait a little bit longer before we can release them. Stay tuned, ideally with a subscription to our newsletter and of course on Instagram. So, reason number one, two big jobs, one big family, only limited time. Reason number two, with most of the recordings now being done remotely, making appointments has become a bit difficult. Not just because of time zones, but also because it apparently is very easy to cancel last minute when it is only a video chat over the internet and not a personal appointment at the gallery. I could release all my anger now about the non-committal times we live in today, but this is not supposed to be a rant, just a statement. And reason number three, who is supposed to listen to all the stuff that is being released now anyway? Especially since COVID-19 forced most of the world into the digital universe, and it feels like everybody is producing new podcasts, new streams, new visuals daily, hourly, by the minute. Total overload, in my opinion. I think it is okay for me to be a bit more laid back now and only bring out a new episode when I feel it can add real value and topics that are not already being unloaded somewhere else. So, please understand that for now, I'm very happy to contribute only when I think it makes 100% sense. Yeah, so, well, that's basically it. I still love doing podcasts, but I also really love to paint and build crazy and intense artwork from wood and spend my working hours in my studio. So, I hope you understand all that and that you rather see me do fucking awesome art. After all, that is what I decided to do with my life a few decades ago, and we all gotta ask ourselves from time to time where we stand on the commitments we made to ourselves. So don't be sad, I'm not gone. I will be back with great content whenever it deserves your valuable time and mine. But for now, please enjoy Helium Talk episode number 80 with Ken Harmon Hashimoto.
Helium Talk.
Your operation is in several cities,
yeah,
right? Across the United States.
So currently I'm in New York. I'm in Brooklyn. I also spend a lot of time in the Bay Area. We have a gallery in San Francisco, or a couple galleries in San Francisco. But I am currently in Brooklyn. I'm probably going to spend more time here, but with coronavirus and all of that, you know, I've been stuck. I was stuck in California for 3 months and now I'm back in New York and now I want to go back to California, but I probably shouldn't. So it's just, it's sort of, you know, travel is a total mess here in the States and just sort of going with the flow. So currently in New York.
All right. So you just already mentioned that it's probably one of the major topics right now. How are you coping with the situation from a gallery point?
You know, we're actually, knock on wood, but we're doing really good right now. I'm happy to say that our sales are just as good as they've always been, if not better. You know, we did lose a fair amount of money by having so many events cancel on us. We had a lot of art fairs cancel on us. We had a lot of conventions cancel on us. We had a lot of pop-up shows cancel on us. So obviously that was a big loss. But just in our day-to-day, you know, our regular monthly exhibitions, our daily online sales have all been really solid. But, you know, I also think that we're in a unique position because selling online has been really the cornerstone to our business since we opened 10 years ago and has really been our focus. So I see a lot of galleries, especially older galleries, now freaking out because they never really depended on online sales. A lot of older galleries followed the more traditional model depended on people walking into the gallery and buying stuff at exhibitions. We've never depended on that sort of walk-in traffic. For us, it's always been collectors around the country, collectors around the world, selling stuff on social media. So this is really the perfect time for our type of business model. Though, of course, with that said, we do have an election coming up in November, which I'm very concerned about. You know, we've got tens of millions of potential evictions happening in this country before the end of the year, which I'm obviously very concerned about. You know, stimulus money possibly not getting, you know, funded for a second go around, or unemployment drying up. So all of those things are major causes for concern. But as of today, we're doing okay. Ask me again in 2 months. I may be standing in a soup line. We'll see.
Well, I think it's like a month by month status quo. I think here's it's a little bit different because I think Germany is not as far advanced in regards to selling online. People haven't really picked up on that, and that's not the fault of the galleries. I think the younger galleries are, you know, having good websites now and having also online, you know, sort of sales possibilities. But it's just like the clients here, they think probably more traditional still, and they kind of, it's always just like, yeah, online isn't fine, but still have to see the work. So I think for galleries here, I think there will be a lot of galleries that will, I mean, right now we're still getting through these months, also because our government has been very supportive. I have to say that in Germany, it's kind of okay, you know, in that regards. But sales are generally all over the place, pretty, you know, sort of pretty low, you know, especially you going online. It's starting to pick up. We have a pretty good online, you know, sort of set up for the gallery, and that's kind of working. But yeah, it's going to be difficult times. But I think it's, there's going to be a lot of galleries that, you know, might be closing. And but I've always been of the opinion that we have a little bit of an oversaturated market anyway. In this terms, there's tons of galleries, tons of shows, tons of exhibitions. Looking at your website, you're working with an enormous amount of artists as well. I mean, but you have several places. Is this probably, you know, sort of the difference in the model as well, working with you know, like traditionally when I started Helium Co, I think we worked with 10 mm-hmm. artists, because that was the only amount of artists we could, you know, seriously, honestly represent. Mm-hmm. And now I think you see more galleries, especially in the United States, who have a really large roster of talents.
Sure. I mean, we're doing 50 exhibitions a year. So, but that's between three spaces plus art fairs plus pop-ups. So, you know, we sort of have to work with a pretty large number of artists just to fill those shows. Sure. But of course, you know, we do have a core roster of about a dozen people who we work with the most regularly. But, you know, even then, you know, artists need 1 to 2 solo shows a year. And, you know, as a gallery, I feel like, you know, there was a time where, you know, many galleries would run exhibitions for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, sometimes 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. you know, for smaller galleries like myself, that's not really possible. We, you know, because my rent is due on the first of every month, and my payroll is due every 2 weeks. And, you know, mm-hmm. if, you know, I sort of need to have a new show every month. But, you know, we do have that core group of artists who get a solo show every 12 months and are in every art mm-hmm. fair and are in every group show and do a print release every couple months. And, you know, many of those artists have been with us for years. Some of them have been with us for a decade. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, I've spoken in my podcast with Ben Venom. He's part mm-hmm. of your roster for many years too, right? So, like, let me just to understand. Hashimoto is the first place you've opened in San Francisco?
No, so Spoke Art was the first gallery, and that opened in 2011. Hashimoto opened in 2013, and then Hashimoto New York was 2015 or 16. Okay.
And you're sharing the roster between these galleries, or
they're pretty independent. Hashimoto San Francisco tends to focus mostly on Bay Area artists. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bay Area gallery scene is a pretty tough one. It's a pretty unique one, and there aren't a lot of opportunities for Bay Area artists. So that's a gap that we try to fill with that location. Mm-hmm. Spoke Art tends to mostly focus on pop culture, illustration, pop surrealism, those types of things. Mm-hmm. And Hashimoto New York shares a lot of the Bay Area artists that Hashimoto San Francisco does, but also tends to bring in more of the international artists or artists from other part of the country.
Mm-hmm. And when you've started, I've read something, I think I read in the San Francisco newspaper somewhere that you've basically started this without planning to run a gallery initially, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, it's been a crazy 10 years, but it was all happenstance and coincidence. And basically I was waiting tables at a restaurant at night and writing for High Fructose Magazine during the day. And a friend of mine, Rod Luff, who's a painter from Australia, currently living in Los Angeles, he was coming to the Bay Area. And, this was before I owned a gallery. And I said, hey, let's do a show while you're in the United States. So I booked a pop-up space in 2011. And, a couple weeks before his show opened, the pop-up space went out of business. And I had an artist coming to San Francisco. I had framed all of the work. The hotels were booked and I didn't have a space. I didn't have a location to host the show. And I found a small gallery space on Sutter Street that was, you know, willing to give me, they wouldn't give me the space for a month. They would only give it to me for a 2 year mm-hmm. lease, but the rent was pretty cheap. And I said, fuck it. Mm-hmm. And I signed a 2 year lease and we opened that show a couple weeks later and it sold out on the opening night. And I just sort of began booking out the gallery as quickly as I could. And here mm-hmm. we are.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to plan.
I mean, no one should open a gallery. Anytime someone asks, you know, they ask me for my opinion or they ask for advice, and I say, don't do it, man. If you're a rich kid, if you're born rich, or if you've got family money and you think you can do this for a few years, go for it. But other than that, man, I don't recommend it.
No, it's tough. It's tough business, but it's. But I mean, there's a certain attraction that led you to build this business out of it. You know, what is it? What drives you? What gets you up in the morning to say, okay, now I'm going to open one of the 50 shows today or plan the next 49?
Sure. I just love what I do. I could make a lot more money doing something else. I'm fully aware of that.
Sure.
Yeah, I could make a lot more money doing other things, but this is what I want to do. This is what I love to do. And, our artists depend on us. You know, many of mm-hmm. them are reliant on us to sell their work and to get their bills paid and get food on their plates. And, we care about our people and we want to take care of them. And that's mm-hmm. really one of the major motivating factors, because if we go out of business, I don't know what many of our artists would do. So it's our responsibility.
Yeah, so you still think that this, because I'm speaking with a lot of, you know, people, gallerists, artists, collectors, you still believe that for an artist it's the best or the ideal way to have a gallery and work with them? Because I mean, there's so many artists out there who will not get into, or at least not steady into galleries, and do you think the model is still functioning, still the right
one? There's never been a better time to be an independent artist, because you can you can have a very successful career without a gallery today. Mm-hmm. You know, you can sell your work on Instagram, you can sell your work on, you know, you can do small art fairs by yourself. I mean, there's so many ways for an artist to make a good living, especially if they're handy with marketing and if they're handy, and then if they're organized and if they have a good sense of business. But many artists prefer to just dedicate, but you know, when you are running your own career and running your own studio, 50% of your time is spent making art and 50% of your time is spent answering emails and selling work and planning your social media and doing all of that. So some artists, prefer to have galleries who can handle those things for them. And I will also say that, you know, galleries are in many way, a good, you know, working with a gallery has its pros and has its cons. You know, the con is that you lose 50% of your sale. A good gallery will earn that 50%. A bad gallery won't. But one of the pros of working with a gallery is that a gallery oftentimes, you know, has better access to museum curators or museum shows. You know, a good gallery can bring you to a good art fair where they can get your work in front of the right people. You know, in a lot of, you know, there are art fairs out there that accept individual artists to have their own individual booths, but, you know, those fairs typically aren't very well attended. You know, you're probably going to get less museum curators walking through those doors, less major collectors walking through those doors. So, you know, working with a gallery has its benefits, but again, the gallery needs to be earning their 50%, and many don't.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think that I think most artists are, I mean, not most artists, I can't, you know, put a figure to it, but I think, I don't believe that many artists are capable of actually running the business side, getting up and, you know, answering emails. And I mean, social media, maybe, yes, because that's not too hard. But following up and, you know, all the preparation that goes into, I mean, this is probably your experience as well, but I would say that 70 to 75% of the artists that we're working with, and they're good artists, they're professional artists, they do not have the proper PR materials or photos at hand. We take a lot of photos for our artists from the works and stuff, so that they have a quality that you can print, for example, and eventually end up in books and catalogs and stuff like that. So I think there are not many artists that are actually, you know, sort of that good in promoting themselves. Maybe it's different in the United States, but it's definitely not the case here. I think if you start out as an artist in Germany, you know, so that is what you want to do, art. And all the rest is something you would, you know, sort of, you don't want to even handle. I mean, I'm writing the invoices for some of our artists, you know. So I'm just basically telling them, this is exactly the text that goes on there. This is the number, this is the date. These are the things that have to be on there. So I sometimes write them.
Sure.
For them, you know, so. But I think it's a good point. It's a fair point. I mean, galleries have to earn those 50%. I'm pretty sure some don't. I think the relationship between you as a person, you know, running a gallery, and your staff, of course, running a gallery, I'm pretty sure you have a couple of good people working for you. If you have so many spaces and locations and fairs and stuff, you need a lot of staff to handle those things. But I think the relationship to the artist is probably one of the most important things that, you know, sort of that, and most, you know, sort of the things that drives you to do this. I mean, I can say the same. I mean, I think I think I wouldn't be very comfortable working too many artists, but we've been, you know, so we've been, you know, looking for new artists. Basically, I don't know how is it with you. I'm not really looking for new artists. They just kind of pop up.
Oh, yeah.
They just, you know, there. They come through other artists or other galleries, or well, I don't know, they just sometimes they just appear. Mm-hmm. Do you find it? Do you add a lot of new artists to your galleries over the course of the year?
We can. You know, it depends. For us, it's a delicate balance. You know, if I were one gallery with, you know, maybe an employee or two, just myself, one location, 10 to 12 shows a year, I would only need 10 to 12 artists to work with. But with three locations and 50 shows a year, you know, the benefit is that those 10 core artists who have been with me for a long time, those artists benefit because they get to do a show this year in New York and next year in San Francisco and the year after in Miami and the year after that in LA and the year after that overseas, because the gallery is growing and successful. But of course, in that now means that we have to fill more slots because we now have more shows, because we now have more spaces, because we're now doing more fairs. So on one hand, it allows us to benefit that core group better. But on the other hand, we also now need to bring in new artists to help fill those gaps and also just to keep things interesting and refreshing and new. So yeah, we bring on, you know, a handful of new artists every year, not too many, but maybe like five mm-hmm. or six, depending mm-hmm. on the year.
Yeah. But you just mentioned fairs. When do you think those come back?
Oh God. Ugh. Who knows, man? I mean, hopefully not till next year. I hope they don't do Miami, but they may. I mean, Florida's crazy. They're opening Disneyland. It's ridiculous to mm-hmm. me, but, yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if a couple art fairs reopen in Miami this December, but mm-hmm. realistically, I would hope that there aren't any art fairs until there's a vaccine, but we'll see. Mm.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, it's on one hand, it's important for many businesses to do those things, and again, it can be, you know, sort of a shot in the foot if you just, you know, do all these things too early. I think there's a fair opening up in Copenhagen at the end of the month. I don't know. I think also I don't think it's much fun going over a fair being, you know, sort of scared a little bit all the time, you know, when you're there and, you know, it's being too protective. And I think that's probably not the right environment for those things. I think it's a time now to come up with different ideas. How do you handle it with your stores, with your galleries, with the spaces? Are they open to the public or do you make appointments with people or you're just going online?
So the New York space is open by appointment. Because it's mm-hmm. large enough and we've got good air circulation in there. The San Francisco galleries are smaller and there's not great air circulation, so we don't really feel comfortable having people in there, both for the safety of our staff and for the safety of our collectors and fans. So that's really a touchy case-by-case basis. But for the most part, the San Francisco galleries are online only. But what we have mm-hmm. been doing, actually, that's been interesting is that our artists in the San Francisco space are looking at ways to present their shows, not just online, but also from the street. So for mm-hmm. example, this month, we have a street artist named Gats, who's a Bay Area street artist. I've been working with him for 10 years. Mm-hmm. This is his fifth solo show with me, maybe. What he did for his show was he pivoted away from the standard white cube presentation that he had planned and created this massive window installation. And then basically put the show in the windows, you know, designed custom vinyl, you know, a lot of custom window vinyl for the top part of the windows, mm-hmm. the sides of the windows, and created, you know, this public art installation that you can view from the street 24 hours a day mm-hmm. In lieu of having that proper show. So mm-hmm. a lot of and I know that our artist next month is looking at ways to do that as well. So it is pretty interesting seeing how people can adjust to not really even mm-hmm. having people come see the exhibition, but only be able to see the exhibition from the street. And what can we do to mm-hmm. make that an interesting viewing experience for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we opened the first time end of April for an exhibition, we had a and also we made a booking mm-hmm. schedule. Everybody could book a slot, just like 3 people at the same time for half an hour. And we did the opening 10 hours long, so from 10 to 8. And that was an interesting experience, very exhausting for us, because then you really have to talk with everyone that comes to the opening, you know. And but it's also, it's a very, very focused interest. There's, nobody's coming to these openings if you're not really want to see the work, and they're just coming around to have a view or a drink, which also is nice, of course. I miss that too. But I mean, it's just like, it's a different thing. And we're having the next opening early September together with all the galleries in the quarter that we're in here in Hamburg. It's like in Hamburg, it's like, it's not one gallery quarter, really. It's like many areas where there are a couple of galleries. And so we're here in what's called Neustadt, and we have like, I think, 6 galleries open at the same time. And so we also do this more or less the whole day long, so people can walk around, you know, sort of, and enjoy an experience. And I think we're all hoping for good weather, because then, which is not necessarily the case in September in Hamburg, but so you can be outside and, you know, sort of, you know, because that's, we have a backyard here, so you can come in the entrance and leave through the backyard.
That's
so
nice.
You know, it's like a one-way street through the gallery. And then you can, from the backyard, can go back to the street. So let's see how that goes. But I mean, I agree. It's, I was in the, initially I was a little bit frustrated, because, you know, I mean, the market goes dry when these things happen very quickly, because people don't necessarily spend their money on art when they have to look out for themselves, which is totally understandable. We're in a kind of a, I don't really like the word luxury, but we're in a luxury area. I mean, none of our artists, or most of the artists that we work with, don't live in luxury, and we certainly don't do either. But it's something that, you know, so it's not really necessary like other things in times of crisis. But what I'm seeing all around, that's what's interesting for me, is that, you know, not just galleries, but also artists come up with different ideas to present stuff. And after the initial wave of doing everything online, like online presentations or live shows online, which I think is too much content, after a while, I think there are some good ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you right now, if I see another online viewing room, I'm going to shoot myself in the head, man. And like, honestly, like half of these online viewing rooms are just, it's just a page of the art. Like there's nothing, like, yeah, that's just what everyone's been doing for the last 10 years. It's not anything special. Don't promote it as such. But going back to your point earlier about people who do come, you know, one thing that we've noticed, so the New York space is not, I mean, it's in a gallery area, but it's not in a condensed gallery area the way like Chelsea is, for example. We're in the Lower East Side. And so to come to the gallery, you really have to want to come to the gallery. You know, you're going to have to get on that train and walk in the, especially now in the summertime, walk in the heat, and it's in the middle of a pandemic and everything's weird. Like if you're going to come to see a show and make an appointment and come to see that show, you really, really, really have to care. You know, because of that, what's interesting is that we're selling more work in person, because instead of an opening where there's 100 people and everyone's, you know, just having free wine and the gallery is packed and no one knows who to talk to and you know, we have 3 people in the gallery at a time, you know, and they can ask questions and they can have conversations. And rather than 100 people who've shown up for the free wine, we now have 3 people who have shown up for the art. And it just feels to me like we're actually selling more art in person now, because we get more FaceTime with those serious, interested collectors than we did before. And of course, I love having, you know, anytime someone comes to the gallery, I'm happy. Even if they don't like the artwork, I'm happy. But yeah, it is interesting. It has changed things a lot, in good ways and in bad ways.
Yeah. I agree. We're at times, but I mean, it's good to see that, you know, sort of you're coping too. And I mean, it's, I have to say, as I said, the online part is not that big in Germany, but I think this could give it, or I hope this might give it a boost, you know, so people understand that it's possible. And we're seeing that it's starting to work. There are other things that are difficult about selling art online directly, you know, through a shop and stuff like that? What if somebody wants to return it after 4 weeks, which basically should be is legally possible, you know, sort of you buy something online at the beginning of an exhibition and then you have a red dot for 4 weeks or 3 weeks at the show and then somebody gets the work and then doesn't like it and gives it back. Mm-hmm. Things like that, you know. But I don't know how you see it, but I mean, I'm in this business for a while and I've always had the feeling or the impression, or not just the impression, but I always think that art is, you got a plane in the background?
Oh, I think that's a, sounds like that was a ambulance, sorry.
I took no worries. Where's it going with... yeah, ambulance really probably out of context. But I mean, this is also the different way of doing the podcasts now, you know, just doing, everybody's doing that as well as running podcasts too. I'm usually doing these in person or most of the time, at least, and it's a lot better. And I totally lost my thread. Where was I going? Well, it doesn't matter. So an ambulance can actually, you know, sort of bring me totally out of context, but, oh no, yeah, the online sales. I think if there's one good thing that might come out of it is that people understand that buying online is purchasing online is a good thing, you know, and is possible. And I think it's a good thing to start to educate people because the art is still the same, you know. And we just have to work on the presentation. When you say online viewing rooms, we actually improved those things. I mean, I don't know, online viewing, I would not make a 3D model of the gallery and have people go through that. I think that's...
It's a cute novelty. There's a lot of galleries that I've seen do it, and I think that it's sort of fun. It's like you're in a video game, but it doesn't replace being there. And to me, it just feels a little gimmicky. I mean, to each their own. I'm sure there are collectors out there who do prefer it. I know that I don't as a collector, but to each their
own. Yeah, a lot of events go do virtual tours and all these things as well right now, you know. So basically you just pay them that they put you online, which I don't know. So, I don't know. I think the physical presence on an art fair, I understand that that's expensive, but I would not necessarily pay for an online art fair. I don't know. But you know, talking about these things, where do you think the gallery business is going? I mean, a lot of things have been changing. We've mentioned fairs. They when we started, there were like I think 3 in Miami going to fairs, and now there's like I don't know 30. Maybe it's, you know, so the market might get a little bit more regulated. Do you have any vision on how the art market might change with or, you know, sort of without COVID? I mean, it's not like we were on the most healthy part track before.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's going to be a lot of galleries that, I mean, I would assume that by the end of this year, there's going to be a few galleries that close who will blame COVID. But in reality, they were on their last leg anyways, and this was just the final nail. Art fairs, we'll see. You know, a lot of these companies that do produce these art fairs, you know, they've got big staff, they've got offices, and... you know, how are you supposed to stay in business for a year if you can't run any physical events? I don't know. But there have been too many art fairs. There are too many galleries. But even then, there aren't enough galleries if you consider the number of artists out there, right? The number of artists is not going to change. If anything, there's probably more artists now post-COVID than there were pre-COVID, right? So... you know, maybe galleries will become a little more elite, which would be disheartening. But yeah, I mean, more than likely, less galleries, less art fairs this time next year. We'll see.
Yeah, I think we gotta see that and gotta try to get through this somehow. So what I've always also seen, I mean, you already also mentioned that before, is another aspect of your business that is pretty strong in the United States, or stronger in the United States than here in Europe as well. It's like you have a lot of print releases. it's a true New York feeling over there.
prints are a pretty important part of our business model. And that was something we learned pretty early on. One of my very first shows ever had this painting of Bill Murray. It was a Wes Anderson themed art show. And we had this painting of Bill Murray that was, I think, like $3,000. And we sold it. And this was one of my first shows ever. This was a big, you know, this is a big sale for me. $3,000, that's a lot of money. And I was so excited. And we got all of these messages, people who wanted prints, who wanted prints. And we're like, okay, yeah, let's try some prints. And so we sold 100 prints for $100 in a day. So we did $10,000 in print sales for a $3,000 painting. And when that happened, I just said to myself, okay, I'm going to go buy one. I'm going to basically use the money that I made on this print sale, and I'm going to go buy a printer. And so we've had our own in-house Giclée print shops basically since the very beginning. And that was entirely informed by that one experience. If that print release hadn't have done as well, then maybe not. But doing our own prints is, you know, so important to us, and it's important to our artists as well. You know, I know that as an art collector myself, I can't necessarily always go out and buy that $10,000 painting. I can't even necessarily go out and buy that $3,000 painting. Can I afford $100 for a nice print from one of my favorite artists? Of course I can. So yeah, prints are, sometimes you make a lot more money doing the prints than you do selling the actual paintings. And that's a lesson that we learned pretty early on.
But that's prints based on the original artwork, right? So it's not, I mean, what's bigger here is individual prints, unique prints that just only exist as print, like silkscreen prints that are made by the artists for that purpose, or, you know, some people do woodblock prints, stuff
like
that.
Yeah, we do that too.
You know, so that's, so that's, but it's also, I mean, I see that, and we're sometimes looking, you know, so a little bit jealous towards the States in regards to, or some artists in regards to print sales. It's here you have to convince people to buy prints unless they're on exhibitions, you know, so directly. And I think you have a much bigger print culture. It also probably goes back to all the rock art posters and stuff like that. You know, so that they really rooted in the art, you know.
That's a really interesting observation. And also maybe it's just like art history too, you know, like, you know, Europe, the old world, you guys, you know, have hundreds of years, thousands of years of fine art appreciation ingrained into your culture, where the United States doesn't. Maybe population density as well. I mean, there's so many people in the U.S. comparatively. So,
yeah. I think that's definitely one aspect. I think traditionally, you know, so there is, they always have been kind of gatekeepers, you know, sort of in terms of art, also for young artists to develop themselves, you know, so traditionally you should go to university and study with a certain professor at your school. So that can, you know, sort of get you into the theory. There's always, in Germany, there's always a difference made between serious galleries, serious artists, and you know, pop culture has just found its way over the past years into acceptance. Now it's, you know, sort of, now it's being accepted, but it took a long time. Whereas I think in America, in the US, pop culture was always embraced as a vital part of, you know, sort of art, you know, and I think a lot of that here with the acceptance here has to do, of course, with street art and graffiti movement, and that a younger generation simply just doesn't care if this artist has studied at a renowned university, or, you know, sort of, it's just a cool artist, you know, cool stuff. So I think things are changing in that direction as well here. But you're true. It's you're right. There's a lot of tradition here. But have you ever done shows outside of the U.S.? Have you ever gone to Europe?
Yeah, you know, we did the Moniker Art Fair in London a couple years ago, and we did an art fair in Paris last year. So those are the two international shows that we've done. I've done a couple shows in Hawaii, which is about halfway there, you know, if you think about it like that. But, you know, I will say that the culture is very different, and especially with street art. You know, street art in the EU and in the UK is still very, very cool, very popular. That's not so much the case in the States anymore. It's still very vibrant, and there's still a big community and a lot of collectors. but I feel like street art actually sells better in the EU mm-hmm. and in the UK than it does in the US. And if you look at the number mm-hmm. of galleries who specialize in that, there aren't even that many in the US anymore. You know, many of them mm-hmm. have closed, or many of them have moved on, have changed their programs. But yeah, it's not as prevalent as it used to be, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you see this here too in our development that the, you know, sort of the galleries that were labeling themselves urban art galleries before, they're just moving into, you know, sort of just dropping everything else around it and just becoming galleries. Because I think that's if you open a gallery, and of course you have a program and you should have a profile, I think that you as the person running it, or the gallerist, or your team, is basically defining, you know, so that when people think about Ashimoto or Spoke Art, they have an idea, you know, what's happening there, but you're still not tied to one art movement, because that would limit, you know, sort of you as a gallery. I think totally you're not open for experiments. You cannot just go and say, okay, this is an artist that I like and I want to show, because it probably doesn't fit into, you know, so like this tight space that you've created.
Sure. No, that's that, you know, and that identity thing has been an issue in general for us. And I think one of the problems is that I like too many things. You know, like I love street art, of course, but I also love this mm-hmm. and I love that. And it's like music, you know, mm-hmm. I don't only listen to rap. I don't only listen to rock. I don't only listen to jazz. I listen to all of these mm-hmm. things. And the gallery in many ways reflects that, but we don't, mm-hmm. you know, I wouldn't know how to categorize us other than we show things that we like, and those things run mm-hmm. the gamut. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, actually, just to go back to the street art thing, something that I noticed a few years ago that I thought was really interesting was maybe like in 2015, I had some new employees at the gallery, and they were young. They were in their early 20s. They were fresh out of art school. They had just graduated from a good art school, and they were working in the gallery. And I remember talking to them about like a street artist that I liked, and they sort of like rolled their eyes at the idea of street art. And mm-hmm. it was so interesting to me, because when I was their age, when I was in my early 20s, street art was exciting. It was new. It was something mm-hmm. that hadn't been seen before. People, artists are taking mm-hmm. their art out of the gallery and putting it on the street. You know, Shepherd Fairey was coming up, and Banksy was coming up. And obviously there were people who came before, but, you know, it was really sort of this cool, underground, new, exciting thing in the late 90s and in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was so fresh and exciting. And to this day, I still love it for those reasons. But for my younger employees now, especially now, you know, if you're 22, street art has always existed. It's always been there. Mm-hmm. It's not anything new. It's not exciting. It's been there since you were born. You know, if you're mm-hmm. if you're 21, street art has literally always existed. Shepherd Fairey has always been an artist of some renown, right? Mm-hmm. And just generationally, every generation wants to do something new. You never want to listen to the same music that your parents listen to. You never want to listen sure. to, you know, have this, be in love with the same actors or actresses or what have you. And so, yeah, I don't know. I just think that it is interesting for us. Like a lot of the younger art fans and art collectors and art world people that I meet, especially those in their early 20s, for them, like, street art is sort of passe, and they're interested in their own narrative. They're interested in their own representation for their own generation, which makes me feel old. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting aspect that, you know, so it exists for such a long time. But also, I sometimes have the feeling, I mean, I still, you know, sort of like a lot of things about it, but it is in these days, everything is just going bigger and bolder and certain in visual terms, maybe, but it also has gotten a little bit boring. And I think if you look at, and this has got nothing to do with it, there's great artists out there, and there's, you know, still great stuff that exists, but it's kind of, Yeah, it's not, as you said earlier, it's not that exciting anymore as it was in the beginning when it really was rebellious and different. And now it's the whole discussion is completely different.
Well, I mean, look at punk rock, right? Look at what punk rock was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and look at what it is today. You know, I don't listen to that poppy punk stuff that the kids, it's terrible, right? But
yeah, it's an interesting thing is that now, you know, sort of punk is bigger than it ever was, but it's this kind of new modern.
Oh, yeah, it's watered down and it's cheesy and it's not coming from an honest place anymore. But what are you going to do?
So that generation has to find those things in art. So how do you have any young employees that come to you and say, here, Ken, look, you know, so this is
the next. You know, I will tell you right now, I am so thankful for my employees. Because they all present different perspectives. And, you know, even, you know, so for example, even today, literally today, you know, we're working on a bunch of these puzzles that we've been working on for a long time. It's so funny. We had started working on like artist design puzzles last year. And then coronavirus happened and China got shut down and all of our plans just went out the window. Which is ironic because if we had had those puzzles in hand, this is the best time to be selling puzzles because everybody's at home. We missed the mark by 3 to 6 weeks. It's really frustrating. But we had been working on this for over a year now. And anyways, we're now sort of getting a bunch of things going for the holidays. And, you know, if I need to get those orders in now, and I'm talking to one of my employees and I say, here's my list of the puzzles that I want delivered by early December. And, you know, she looks at it and she's like, listen, this is a good list, but it's all white males. Where are the artists of color? Where are the female artists? And I'm like, fuck, you're totally right. Like, it wasn't an intentional thought. Obviously, I didn't wake up yesterday morning and say, I'm going to curate a puzzle series with a bunch of white male artists, right? That wasn't my intent. It's just sort of the way it unfolded, and I was in a rush and I was thinking, okay, what's going to sell? And she comes with this new generational perspective of, hey, take a step back, look at it from this angle that you weren't looking at it from before. So that's now a conversation that we're having, and it's a conversation I'm glad we're having. But, you know, especially our younger employees are looking at things, you know, through that lens. And, you know, they have a whole, you know, their idea of gender and identity politics are totally different than the concepts I grew up with, right? And so their perspectives are totally different and totally refreshing. So, they are very valuable, and I'm very thankful for them.
Yeah, it also has a lot of influence in, I think, the art and the artist and the background of the art. I think what you just mentioned, that there we have, I mean, I honestly, I think 20, 30, 40 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that wasn't, you never thought about, you know, having diversity in a gallery exhibition, you know, sort of in terms of the artist, you know, in terms of the art. Yes, you were trying to look, you know, sort of that if you have a group show that you spread it out. But now it's always part of the thought process. And I think that's a valuable thing.
Definitely.
You know, especially considering the times. When you mentioned puzzles, we have a gallery in Hamburg. Friends of mine, Affenfaust, they started at the beginning of Corona and produced puzzles and have been quite successful with that.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's probably a good market for that right now. You know, and it's also, I think it's also interesting that you, as a gallery, you go that way, you know, and you just say, well, why not? Why not a puzzle? Why not a print? Why not? You know, so that's something that has, I mean, it has come up with Murakami and all these artists, of course, you know, so it's there for a while, but being part of art, or that art is part of your life today, is different than before. It is not elite anymore, because you cannot just go to the museum and look something that you can't afford, or you cannot go buy a painting, you know, because you don't have the money. But now you can have a part of the art in terms of form of a print, or, you know, sort of a puzzle.
Sure.
You know, I think
our artists need it as well, right? I mean, if our artists were dependent only on selling 12 paintings a year, those paintings would have to be very, very expensive. You know, so Being able to offer both those prints and those puzzles and those small pieces and those additions and whatever, you know, is also just so that our artists can make a living. I actually do want to go back to the topic of identity and race and diversity, because that is really the big thing right now. You know, 5 years ago, it was how many women are in your program. You know, 5 years ago, it was Women's Day. It was pink hats at protests. You know, why are museums all males? You know, how come there aren't more women? Where the Gorilla Girls have been saying this for decades. But, you know, I feel like 5 years ago, it was, you know, that was sort of the conversation. Now the conversation is diversity in terms of, you know, how many Black artists do you have on your roster? You know, how many trans artists do you have on your roster? How many gay artists do you have? How many queer artists, et cetera? And something that I'm very curious to see is what next year is going to look like, because, you know, there's a lot of galleries now who are thinking these questions and asking these questions and trying to come up with solutions. And of course, you know, it takes a year or two for change to happen in the gallery world, because galleries are booked 1 to 2 years in advance. So if I want to bring on a bunch of new artists this year, their shows won't happen until 2021 or 2022. So what will the gallery landscape look like next year is sort of an interesting question. And more importantly, is it going to look like, how many galleries out there are just going to, are saying to themselves now, oh, I need a Black artist, boom. You know, oh, I need a trans artist, boom. And is that, and I guess my concern here is that I'm concerned that what we're going to have is we're going to have a bunch of galleries patting themselves on the back because they said, oh, look at my schedule. I had 4 Black artists this year. And, you know, that's it. And it's just sort of a Band-Aid, and the gallery then moves on. And they're just trying to, I guess my concern is that galleries will like sort of tokenize their artists by saying, look, I have one of each. I'm a good gallery. As opposed to saying, hey, like, where, how can I find the right artist for my program who I can work with for the next 10 years and grow their career and be thoughtful and create something sustainable and long-lasting versus something that is a knee-jerk reaction to an important question, but how you answer that question remains to be seen. So that was sort of a long rant. And
I understand. I mean, the issue is not solved by just saying, okay, let's, you know, I need, you know, sort of diversify my artist roster, and I'm just taking this one and this one and this one and her and him, and, you know, because that kind of fits the time right now, and then next year nobody's interested in those artists anymore. You're not helping anyone. I mean, the one thing has to remain. If you cannot see the potential in the artist, if you don't want to work with this person, if you don't want to, you know, sort of see something very unique and special. I think we both, you know, sort of, I mean, if we both look at 10 artists, you know, like more or less blindly, we would not necessarily pick the same artists out of that lineup. You know, we probably have different opinions about them. So, and when you're passionate about an artist and you bring him on, then you can work with this artist. And I think there's no need in, you know, sort of just taking somebody just because, you know, sort of it's a person of color, you know.
And to be frank, it's not fair to the artist. You know, I mean, a solo show is a big undertaking.
Yeah, that's what,
right?
I mean,
you know, if an artist works on a solo show, that could be 6 months of their time. That's thousands of dollars in materials and studio space and energy and work. And if that show fails, or if that show doesn't do well or doesn't sell well or what, or doesn't get press or whatever your goal for that show is, you know, if you don't reach that goal, you've got an artist who's now thousands of dollars in debt, who's sitting on this body of work that they can't move. And what, the gallery gets to pat themselves on the back by saying, look at how diverse I am, or I'm such a good gallery. Like, no, that's not the answer. That's actually harming the community that you're trying to help. And how we all navigate that in the coming years remains to be seen. And I'm really interested to see, because, you know, I know where my weaknesses are. I think I have a really solid program of female artists, you know, on our roster in general. You know, I have a lot, oddly enough, I have a lot of Hispanic artists. I'm not, it just sort of happened that way. But yeah, we do need more Black artists. You know, I'll be the first to say that. Mm-hmm. And we do need more queer artists. I'll be the first to say that. But how do we do that in a way that actually helps that community? How do we do that in a way that actually creates these sustainable long-term careers for our artists without just rushing to just show whoever needs representation today, you know? Yeah, it's really complicated and really difficult. And I know that that's something that we're working on and, you know?
Even though that's pretty embarrassing to say, it's a pretty young discussion still, and something that, you know, sort of ways, you know, so as you said, I mean, the impact will not be now. It's not, I mean, of course, you know, everybody's writing about it, and when you get the Artsy newsletter, there's like 10 Black artists to follow or whatever, you know, so that's, you know, that's the thing. But I think it's just like the sustainable part of it will be seen in 1 or 2 years. So, but on that note, when you said it's unfair to an artist because then the show might be unsuccessful, how patient are you when you have new artists and do solo shows with them? You know, I mean, the first show doesn't sell, Miami doesn't work out, next show doesn't sell. You still encourage the artist to continue working with you, or you think it's a better place for it?
I mean, that's tricky, right? Because, you know, we have over the years, we've had artists whose work I've loved it so much. It was such great work. But if I can't sell it, I can't sell it. You know, if I don't have the collectors for it, I don't have the collectors for it. And, you know, I have to ask myself, am I doing this artist a disservice by having them give me another solo show that I may not be able to sell? You know, if that artist is lucky, maybe they're in a position where they can afford to do that. Maybe they have a day job or they teach or what have you. But, you know, if it doesn't work out for them, it doesn't matter how good the work is, how much I love the work. You know, that's really that, and that's the tough part. And we've had artists where we had to part ways because it didn't really make sense for us to work with them, and it had nothing to do with the work. It had nothing to do with the quality of the work. It had, you know, it's just maybe it was just bad timing. Maybe I did my job poorly. I mean, I don't know, right? But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we try to like lead up to a show about a year in advance. So right now, for example, you know, I am talking to my artists who have solo shows next year, and we're saying, okay, we've got 12 months. We're going to do a print release in 2-3 months. We're going to get you in this group show in 6 months. We're going to bring you to this art fair in 9 months, and then your solo show will be in 12 months. And we're going to do everything we can to build up interest, especially if you're new to the gallery, especially if our collectors don't know who you are. And we are going to try to build something for you in advance so that your show can be successful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you develop a strategy, which makes total sense. Yeah.
And I mean, those are literally the conversations I'm having today. So.
Yeah. So any... do you have any recommendations for younger artists or emerging artists, you know, sort of to get into the business, or if they want to start out, become famous, such as some of the artists that you're representing? It's probably a question that you asked many times, but it's always a lot of things that people like to hear in my podcast, because there's a lot of artists listening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that much of this has probably been covered before. I've listened to a few of the podcasts that you've had with Jonathan Levine, and I agree with Jonathan on virtually 99%. He and I have our differences for sure, and we have our disagreements, but 9 times out of 10, I'm going to agree with anything Jonathan says. And I think that he and I actually have very similar worldviews and perspectives. So I know that he's, if you're an artist, go back and listen to Jonathan's podcasts, and he will tell you the unadulterated frank truth, and he will hold no punches, and he won't always be right, but he's right about 99% of the time, if you ask me. But yeah, you know, I mean, good luck.
Yeah, I think it's, I think if you start out in this, just, you know, always consider that this is not a career. I mean, not a plannable career, at least. It's something you have to want to do, you know, it's, I mean, you have to get up in the morning and say, you know, so I'm an artist. That's what I do. I heard a very, very long podcast recently with David Cho.
Oh, he was on like Joe Rogan or something, right?
Yeah, like Joe Rogan. Yeah, exactly. And it's a very long podcast. And it's a David Cho. I mean, met David Cho many, many years ago in Miami, you know, before the whole Facebook thing. And we always, you know, kind of appreciated, you know, sort of, you know, the thoughts that we both had towards the art world and everything. And then always struggle. But at some point, he's just saying something that, you know, sort of, at some point in the whole discussion, he says, you know, so I thought, fuck it, I'm an artist. That's all I am. You know, basically that's it. You know, that's the essence of it. If you're an artist, you know, forget about everything else. Forget about the next print release or whatever. Let's be, I mean, not that you shouldn't think about it. I don't want to make your business now more complicated when all the artists say, no, Ken, that's your part of the job. It is it, you know, and it's something you can think about and you should think about. I think the first thing is, I mean, I've been an artist for over 30 years, more or less. I've, you know, sort of, I sometimes have to come back to that point where I'm an artist again. You know, we just let everything loose and just don't give a shit about everybody else and just think about, all right, this is, you know, sort of me, you know, this is just, I have to let it
sure.
And I think then I know I work with a lot of artists from the gallery perspective who are understandably impatient. They, you know, so if they grow, they get older, they start a family, they have kids, they have bills to pay suddenly, and they don't necessarily pay easily through the sale of artwork, you know, so... Yeah, good luck. Yeah, I think that sums it up very nicely. I think that's what you just said earlier. Yeah, good luck, and you know, just, you know, stay in the game if you want to, and if not, if it's too hard.
Well, I mean, or just make art. You know, I mean, that's really it. Like, as long as you're making it, you know. And I think actually, it's funny that you mentioned David, because I do think that he's sort of a great example of that. You know, like if you look at, okay, sure, he's a multimillionaire now because of this Facebook thing, but, you know, I mean, I, you know, he was in the Bay Area for a long time in San Jose. And so I sort of had met him through that, through, you know, before the Facebook thing as well, and through Upper Playground. And like, you know, David never really, you know, he was always an artist through and through. And if you look at even that example of that Facebook story, right, you know, he goes to some, you know, one of many new tech startups, and they say, hey, paint a mural. And he says, how much does it pay? And they said, well, we'll give you a couple grand, or you can just have some of this worthless stock and maybe one day it'll be worth something. And David didn't give a fuck. And if he were smart, he would have said, give me the $3,000 or whatever. But he didn't care. He just wanted to make art, and this seemed like a funny thing. And, you know, maybe he didn't need the money that day and said, cool, you know, and he just went with it, and it wound up being the right decision to make. I don't think, I don't know if I would have made that. I probably would have just said, hey, oh, give me the $2,000 and I would be kicking myself for that. Right. But David's primary concern, let's say that day, wasn't how am I going to, you know, make some money today? It was more, oh, cool, this isn't funny. At the very least, it's a funny story and something interesting, and I get to paint a mural and maybe they'll buy me lunch and that's that, you know? So that attitude wound up working for David, you know, in many, many ways. It was a life, changing decision for him. Yeah.
Yeah. So don't count on those
things. Yeah. Don't just give away free murals to every single person, you know, hoping to get stock options, but.
Yeah, I think it's also, I mean, it's part of, it's an educational issue. I think if you go to university right now or study art or whatever, you should also learn about the business. You should be, you know, sort of understand those things, but that's only helpful. You know, the bottom line is, you know, just to art. And it's, I don't know. I mean, do you see yourself with the gallery sometimes as a gatekeeper saying, okay, you have to stay outside and you're allowed in. But because, I mean, people come knocking at the door, or do you think it's just like, this is just how it goes? It's just like natural flow of the business that you can't have show everyone. And
yeah, you know. I mean, even like, you know, to be fair, like, yeah, to some degree, I mean, obviously we have like a certain level that we aim for in the consistency of the work that we show. But at the same time, I mean, you know, there's a lot of great work that we don't show, again, because it doesn't fit with our gallery or it doesn't fit with our programming. And maybe it would do great with that gallery down the street from me. That's a more successful, bigger, more popular gallery than I am, you know, but that would be, you know, this particular work may be in line with that gallery more so than with mine. So am I a gatekeeper in that sense? I don't think so. But yeah, because again, sometimes there's great work that we can't show, even though we love it. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I will say that what is a little scary to me today is the number of artists who are achieving success on social media and are having a million followers, 2 million followers, 3 million followers. And artists who reach that point oftentimes run a risk where they're not getting the necessary proper critical feedback that they would get from a gallery. And, you know, when you're that successful or that popular and everything you post gets a bajillion likes and a bajillion comments and a bajillion people saying, oh my God, this is amazing, you're a genius, it sort of gets to a person's head after a while, no matter who you are. And, you know, galleries have been gatekeepers traditionally in the past, but now you sort of don't need galleries because of social media. But, you know, they're a qualified gatekeeper does go a long way. So yeah, changing times.
Do you think, going to the last thing, you know, sort of I want to get into just quickly, you started, we had that topic in the beginning. Do you think right now it's very important for artists to, I mean, if they can, if they do, to be, to have a political voice as well? As a, can a gallery also, you know, sort of help, you know, sort of help us create a better future? I mean, you have an imminent threat in November coming up in the United States.
And, you know, I'll tell you right now, we don't give two fucks. Like, I'm happy to lose followers. And I do. And I mean, just last week we posted something on one of the gallery accounts, that was political, and we had people, you know, to be frank, I think a lot of them were just, you know, Russian trolls, you know, I don't think they were real people. They're just pro Trump idiots and, you know, whatever, man. Yeah, I'll say that. I don't give a fuck. And if you don't like that, you don't have to buy art from me. I'm okay with that. But you know, for our artists, I mean, yeah, making art by definition should be a political act, right? I mean, the process of making art should be a political act, even if it's not overtly political. And, at the very least, if artists do, you know, do make it known where they stand, I know who to show and who not to show, you know, because I see artists who, you know, look at Charles Kraft, right? I mean, you know, we can talk about him because he passed away a couple years ago, but, you know, I loved his work. And then I found out that it wasn't ironic. And I found out that he actually did believe the Holocaust was fake and he was a white supremacist, right? And like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Like, I used to like your work and now I don't. And I will not support you anymore. And I'm glad that, you know, he let his voice be known because of that. But yeah, I don't know, you know. The scary thing is that, you know, on one hand, I want us to be anti-Trump. Like what position do we take, right? You know, if we're anti-Trump, is that, you know, he won because he was able to get people to be anti-Hillary. You know, like he was able to like build up that hatefulness and that spite and that disgust with liberals and with Democrats and with the gays and with the blacks and all of that. And, you know, sweep his way into the presidency. And, you know, part of me wants it to be, well, fuck Trump, you know, that should be our platform. But an anti-Trump platform isn't what is necessarily going to win, perhaps. You know, like if you look at like Nixon's second term, for example, right? McGovern just wasn't interesting enough, or he didn't motivate people. And the anti-Nixon the anti-Nixon stance didn't work. And I think actually even Andy Warhol did a piece that said, vote McGovern. And it was a picture of Nixon, right? It wasn't even a picture of McGovern, right? That wasn't the point. And it didn't work then. So is that going to work now? I don't know. But we'll find out in November. I don't know. Maybe I'll move to Germany. Maybe you can help me set up a gallery there.
You can move in here.
Your rent's probably a lot cheaper than what I'm currently paying. So
my rent is definitely cheaper.
I'm down for that.
No, that's for sure. I mean, that's, you have a different situation over there and here. Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I mean, Ken, this was a long time in the making. I know we tried to have a chat right in the beginning when I did the isolation episodes where I talked to people that couldn't go out, leave their house from the art community.
Sure. It'll probably be a much different world. I mean, if you consider how much the world has changed, you know, from what was it? When did you first reach out? Like February or March or April, I think. We'll see where we're at in November. We'll do a follow up.
Yeah. Ken, thank you for doing this. Yeah, shout out to Ben who established the
contact. Thanks, Ben.
All right, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this one. There are some hiccups along the way, especially the bit where I forgot where I was going. Well, that shit happens too, so I left it in. It's just part of being real, I guess. I very much love that we talked about really burning issues too. I'm very thankful to Ken for being honest and open about everything. Good talking to him. Thanks again to Ben Venom for setting this up, and let's all make plans to see each other in the United States of America again once we manage to get the virus out of the system and the idiot out of the White House. To show my appreciation for American culture, I secretly sneaked some quick, dirty, and auto-recorded Americana love in here at the end of the podcast. Have a good one, stay safe and sane and beautiful.
Helium Talk. To Denver, see if I can find I'm going out to Denver, see if I can find that loving Colorado girl of mine. With a promise in her smile, chains the mountains tall. Well, the promise in her smile, chains the mountains tall. She can bring the sun to shining, tell the rain to fall. Been a long time, Mama, since I heard you call my name. Been a long time. I heard you call my name. Gotta see my Colorado girl again. I'm going out to Denver, see if I can find I'm going out to Denver, see if I can find that loving Colorado girl of mine. That loving Colorado.